Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Ramp Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friends, my partner in radio, Barnabas Piper. Pipe, just you and me this morning. I assume Ronald's like busy ransacking the Ashland University football building to get his costume together for this weekend. Do you have any updates on that? Do you have any updates on Ronald's costume making ventures vis-a-vis the football uniform?
I don't. There was an Instagram post or series of Instagram posts earlier this week. You know, their church does a fall fest kind of thing because churches can't do Halloween. And so those pictures of his wife in her costume, you know, he mentioned it was her and friend doing sort of a bald theme. So there was like a Hulk Hogan and some different ones. Ronnie was conspicuously absent from these photos. So I don't know if that means there's going to be like a big reveal later, or he hadn't quite pulled it all together, or what the plan was or is, but no updates on his, you know, Necrol number 55 costume.
Yeah. Like Ronnie being absent from photos is a sentence that I don't think I've ever heard in my life. So that gives me concerns. Like maybe he's sick, you know, maybe we need to check in. He's never met a camera that he's shied away from.
Yeah. I mean, him being absent from photos is a little bit like Kanye being silent. You're like, oh, there's something big coming down the pipeline, possibly controversial, might get him canceled. Let's find out.
Exactly. No, you're right, man. It'll be interesting to see what transpires if we actually get some Ashland football shots from Big R. But Pipe, we have radio to do regardless. And we're going to do that radio right after this quick break.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, Pipe, we're back. You had a great idea for kind of what to talk about today. We're gonna walk through each of us sort of our histories with church and our histories with the church, and where we've gone over the years and what those experiences have been like. But you mentioned something off the air that I was really intrigued by. You gave a talk recently to a high school group about deconstruction and not deconstructing. And I, just as a speaker, as someone who speaks to high school kids somewhat frequently, I wondered how that went over. Like, what was their reaction to it? And it could be like stuff that people said to you afterwards or nonverbals or whatever. Like, how on their radar is that issue?
Yeah. So the most recent one I did was to youth leaders, and that's a whole different audience. Gotcha. And then I've spoken, you know, I have spoken on sort of faith and doubt, and I don't use the term deconstruction when I'm talking to teenagers, because as I told their leaders, I don't think any teenagers deconstruct because they haven't constructed enough to actually deconstruct. Like, this is all just formation, not changing anything. So, when I talk to high schoolers about faith and doubt, I usually feel like I'm talking to, it's a little bit like lecturing the dogs that live in my house. You know, they kind of stare at me blankly. Sometimes they get up and walk out of the room. One of them is locked in real intently, but probably because there's food at the end of it, you know, there's some real similarities there.
Yeah.
But, and the only thing that gives me a sense of like, this is worth it is A, I know that, you know, anytime you speak truth from God's word, it you're planting seeds. And that is my sole hope when speaking to high schoolers is like, I'm going to say something that they'll remember down the road. They will come to life. The other is there's usually one or two kids who come up with real pointed questions afterwards, either because they want to argue, which is fun, not to argue with them, but to sort of redirect the conversation. Because what they want to argue, but there's usually something underneath it. Or with the really sort of like embarrassing personal questions, or what they think is embarrassing. They don't realize how normal it is to be like, hey, I've been to church my whole life. I don't know what I think about the Bible.
Right.
They're ashamed of that question. And in reality, you're like, that's a good question.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be ashamed to ask that, because if you don't ask it, it's going to eat you up. So those are the things that are, that I kind of, I come away with and go, well, that was worth it. It was a lot of blank stares, a lot of wandering out of the room, and then two or three interactions that I go, okay, there was life in the room. The Lord did something.
No, I think that's spot on. And that's definitely been my experience as I've spoken at these camps and things over the years. And as I get older, I think I get more paranoid about like if I'm doing a good job with that age group, you know, and wondering even what that looks like. So I'm always up for tips on how to connect there.
You and I talked about this. Maybe we did sort of it was after one of your camp speaking recap engagements.
Yeah.
And sort of talking about it, I think it's gotten harder to speak to high schoolers because high schoolers have gotten worse at listening. And I don't mean that like the grumpy old man, but just sort of the data of like how technology and 30-second video clips have changed attention spans.
Yeah.
I will say talking to youth leaders is a whole different environment. So I spoke at a conference that called Rooted, which is, it's a really good ministry serving people in youth ministry. So not sort of the fun and games and bells and whistles, but really discipleship focused and meaningful. Those people are hungry, like desperate to figure out how to more effectively serve adolescents.
Yeah.
Because I think they do it every day and they feel the same thing we're talking about. How do you get through to them? And then there's a sense of sort of not panic because they trust the Lord, but close to panic because they constantly feel on the edge of losing the teens, you know, that so being able to offer any sort of reassurance, any sort of encouragement, any sort of insights and not sort of silver bullet, you know, do these two things and everything's going to be great, but just, hey, remember these foundational truths.
Yeah.
You can almost see a visible sense of relief land on some of them. And they're like, oh, right. I had lost sight of that in the midst of my panic.
Yeah, absolutely. And even just as the cultural and like publishing winds have blown over the last 20, 25 years, like nobody's talking or writing about being a youth pastor anymore, except to make fun of it. You know what I mean? So like all the sort of books and resources and encouragement that used to be out there for youth pastors, that's all going to like, I don't know, church planners or whatever the sexy thing is to be now. Like all the focus is going there, but yeah, there's still, and I meet them. I meet guys out there who are like slogging away at youth ministry and they tell me what they do for a living. And I'm like, oh yeah, that still exists. That's still a thing, you know?
And there's almost a sense of embarrassment now.
Yeah,
it seems
totally.
Like it used to be sort of like, yeah, I'm the youth guy. Now it's sort of like, I'm you know.
Yeah. They're saying
I'm
it like
guy.
In a whisper, like out of the side of their mouth, you
and
know?
And then they wait for the jokes about whatever, the jokes that are probably dated at this point, because honestly, I know that version of youth ministry still exists. I was at a church several months ago that does sort of the big bells and whistles youth ministry. But most of the people in youth ministry I know are not cool people.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
I should say they're not trying to be cool people. They're just, they're there for exactly the reasons you would hope they are. They're like, I don't know. I want to teach teens how to love Jesus. Yeah. I want to exemplify it. I want to build friendships. I want to give them a safe place to be honest. And you kind of look at that and you go, I think those are all the right ingredients.
Noble. Yeah. It's really admirable. In fact, like I see more kind of ridiculous 45 and 50 year olds in my life trying to be cool. And that's way sadder. You know what I mean? So like the 28 year old or 30 year old guy doing youth ministry is really just typically a hardworking dude trying to get it right. You know?
And it's so hard. No teenager thinks any old person is cool. They either trust them or don't trust them. And that's not based at all on coolness anymore. And kids see right through that. So if you walk in and there's a genuineness about you, you're going to work even if you're the dorkiest person.
Right.
And if you're trying to be cool, you're either going to draw the wrong kids or it's going to be a super shallow thing, or they're just going to be like, yeah, I don't buy it. You're full of crap. And so it's, what works for people our age and older, the kids aren't buying, you know?
Yeah, so
the sexy pastor thing is completely, they just did one big eye roll to people under the age of 25.
It's so ridiculous. Yeah. It's completely ridiculous. Can I ask you a question on coolness? Because I've always kind of been interested in this topic. Like, could you identify even a couple people who you think are actually cool? And the reason I ask this, like, there's a section of my feature writing class where we watch like part of an episode of The Last Dance, the Jordan documentary. And every time I watch it, I'm like, oh my gosh, that guy's cool. You know, like, everything he does is cool. He looks cool. He looks cool while he's playing. He looks cool while he's doing an interview. But beyond that, I can't think of too many people. And in fact, Jordan was not cool at relationships. I don't think anyone would say he has a lot of friends or he's even especially well-liked. So, like, who's cool, you know?
Well, and I it's hard to say because I don't think there is a cultural standard of cool anymore. Cool used to be trendsetter.
Yeah.
You know, like, everybody wanted to be Jordan. You know, Miles Davis was like king of cool because Miles Davis was doing music and had a vibe about him that other people didn't have. Now, cool is an attempt to be like other people.
Yeah.
And that never resonates. You're always like, well, that's derivative. And when people try to be original now, they're weird. You know, Prince was cool. Like, what is original now? Everything is like the boundaries of everything have been pushed to such a level now, or to such an extreme now that you're like, I don't know. Y'all are just weird. Which means I think cool is more about charisma and sort of chill self-confidence. Is somebody comfortable in their own skin? Like Tom Hanks, cool.
I agree.
Which is funny because he gives off none of the cool vibes that would have been true in 1993. But he's...
Yeah. Right. Like, he's not coming over and talking about...
Yeah, like, and like...
You know,
nor is like, you don't watch him walk down the street like, and
he's,
go,
he's
like,
being Tom
there's
Hanks.
An aura about that guy. But everybody likes him. Everybody trusts him. He's genuine. He's got a reputation as as just like one of the nicest men in Hollywood. And there's sort of a sense of like, that's pretty cool. And I kind of feel like that, I mean, that's a positive trend. If that falls in the category of cool and something we can aspire to. Yeah. There's not a, when I think about all people who have sort of stereotypically been cool, all of them are people we would want to knock down a peg now. You even see it in like,
yeah, that's true. Because when you see someone who like knows that they're cool, that's the person. I think we even mentioned this on like, I don't know, some conversation about who we want to make fun of a couple of weeks ago. Like when I see someone who's like clearly puffed up on their own sense of how cool they are, I just want to like, you know, savage that person.
Yes.
And usually I do.
And you can see it in like advertising. You know, it used to be that You put a famous person in advertisement and their very presence was cool enough to sell a product or to make people interested. Now you get like Johnny Depp doing these weird, like, what is it? Aqua Di Gio.
Where he's like playing a guitar in the desert or whatever. And it's ridiculous.
And it's, I don't think it's supposed to be sort of ironically cool.
Yeah.
But it definitely isn't like there's just irony layered with layers of irony there. Or like the, what's his name? The Lincoln commercials with the all right.
McConaughey.
That guy.
Yeah.
Yes. And so those, you know, he's like whispering these long diatribes about I don't know, freedom in the wilderness.
Yeah, like lyric poetry about what makes a good life as he's like waiting at a train tracks in his Lincoln.
Yeah. You know? And like that, I mean, I guess there's supposed to be a coolness about that. And in reality, you're like, this is absurd. Nothing about this is cool.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. I think what is cool now is to undermine cool.
Yes. However, and I'll give you one, and I think you're going to agree with me on this. So, like, remember last year when Gardner Minshew got into a couple of games and he got to play against the Jets and he led, like, a comeback and his dad was in the stands. And then somebody took that video of Minshew, like, giving his dad, like, a huge hug after the game and they were so fired up. Like, that was cool. I'm like, that guy's cool. I don't care what context we're in. If we're like, you know, waiting for an airplane together at 2 a.m. in Newark, that guy's cool. He's going to be a fun hang. You know, he's completely comfortable with who he is. He's wearing a bomber jacket. You know, he's got a mullet and a mustache and he's just doing it because he enjoys it. That's a cool person, you know? So that struck me as pretty cool. Where are you at on like something like that?
Yeah. I mean, I think I agree with that sort of moment. And again, there's a Tom Hanksiness to that. I'm going to use him as he's the Mendoza line of cool.
I think so.
And because there's a genuineness, you can tell, like, if somebody seeks out their parents are never cool. And so if somebody seeks out their parents to respect them, to love them, to celebrate with them, there's just, you look at that and you go, oh, that's
genuinely cool.
Yeah, that's not, nobody's posturing here.
Right.
But I'm also, I mean, we've talked about this so many times on the show. I'm also super jaded by the curation of moments.
Totally.
And so if you can tell that a moment just happened, it wasn't curated and there's genuineness in it. So like I saw a story the other day about, Kentucky basketball had their blue and white game. So it's an inter-squad scrimmage, but I think they do them not in the normal arena, but like places where fans who couldn't normally go to the games can attend. And it's a big deal for Kentucky fans. And there was a guy captured on camera he's wearing like an orange, like a bright orange work vest, gray clothes, and he's just covered in coal dust.
Dude, I saw that.
At the game with his like 6-year-old son. It was his son's first Kentucky game. And so he came straight from work to be there for his son's first game rather than going home and showering and missing part of the game and, you know, diminishing the experience. And again, now at this point, it's an overtold story. But the moment where you capture this and you're like, that's a good dad having a cool moment with his son. Like that guy's the guy you want to be friends with. That's a cool guy.
Oh, absolutely. And the garbage element of that was that someone was there with a camera to ruin it. And then a whole bunch of other someones used it to like, I don't know, do whatever they were trying to accomplish. And that's why the runway from something genuinely cool to everybody getting jaded and burned out. Like, it's like a half a week, you know, it's like 2.5 days. And what a shame, you know, because that was and is a genuinely cool move by that dad and a genuinely cool moment. But like everybody, you know, using it and then being burned out by it. It's such a short runway, man. And I hate that about the world we live in. And even myself, like I hate how sort of critical I get of things and how quickly it happens. You know what I mean? And I think.
Well, and of things that are definitively worthy of, at the very least, a thumbs up, probably worthy of praise. Like that dad deserves respect.
Because 100%, dude.
Coal miners, I'd have never been a coal miner, but by the impression that I have is that they work really hard.
Yeah, just shout out to that guy for putting in like a full hard day of work, you know, which is like a revolutionary act anymore.
Yeah, I mean, he's busting his tail, gets off work, and the first thing he thinks is, well, I can't take a moment away from my kid. So it's his first game. This may be the one opportunity they're going to have this year to do this thing. And so he goes and does it. If more dads did more things like that, there would be a lot more, you know, good men in the world because the sons would grow up better. And all that's worthy of praise. And also, I'm tired of talking about it.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's fascinating the way that happens. And Pipe, we should take another ad break, and then we'll come back and talk about the thing that we had planned to talk about. We'll be back in 2 and 2. All right, Pipe, we're back. The suggestion that you made via text was a good one, to just kind of walk through our histories with church. And I don't know how you want to do this. Do you want to kind of back and forth it, like start in early childhood and work our way up through it? Because I'm guessing for both of us, with all the kind of moving around that we've done and the different career stuff we've done, we've landed in different cities and different contexts and had different experiences with the church. So get us started, man. Like, earliest childhood memories of church, of the church.
Yeah.
What do you got?
I mean, I have zero memories in life that are not kind of in the either the shadow or the glow of church, depending on,
yeah,
you know, how you feel about it. Because my dad became the pastor of Bethlehem Baptist Church 3 years before I was born.
Yeah.
So I was born Holy Week of 1983. And so I think I was born on Maundy Thursday. Well, okay. You know, my dad and brothers were at the Maundy Thursday service, which was a thing that we did back then. And my mom was at the hospital. Wow. I think my dad left the service to go to the hospital for my birth, something along those lines.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So, I mean, I grew up in it, and we lived my whole life within walking distance of the church, same house.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the church was, I mean, we were, it was not just a thing that we did. I mean, it was like, it was the neighborhood. It was the playground, walking over to see dad at church. You know, it was an 8 minute walk, 10 minute walk, something like that.
Yeah.
Riding the bike over, whatever. And by and large, I loved church growing up. I mean, there were definitely pressures and difficulties, especially as a pastor's kid, and I'd written about all that. But for the most part, I loved church. Not always for the right reasons. You know, I think I loved access. I loved feeling special because my dad was the boss. Those kinds of things that kids feel, where you're just a little cooler than the other kids because you know your dad's famous in this tiny circle. And but also, like, all my friends were through church. I mean, that kind of hasn't changed. My closest friends have always been through church, not work, not school, etc. So that was, I mean, I was at that church from birth through high school graduation when I moved away and went to Wheaton.
Yeah.
And at no point did I wish I was at another church. In fact, I mean, I think about, like, in youth group where they would do, like, the big youth group get-togethers, like youth conferences or lock-ins at the, you know, the big sports, you know, with the batting cages and all that stuff. And I always just resented the other churches. I was like, these are so, like, look at these lame youth groups. Ours is so much better than this, which is, again, trash attitude.
Yeah.
But there was a sense of sort of fierce loyalty there that I really loved the church that I grew up in. At least relationally. I think my relationship with the Lord was at a whole other place, but the church and my relationship with the church was strong.
That's great, man, and that's really endearing, and it's really refreshing and good to hear. And I would say, by and large, my relationship with it was similar. So, like, early childhood, I grew up in, like, a truly small town, right? So there was no college, there were no, like, kind of cool churches. We were a little cornfield town in the middle of nowhere, blue collar Indiana. And when I was really young, we went to just, like, the Methodist church in town because it was one of the only options to go to. And I remember, like, going to Sunday school classes there and doing, like, super early childhood stuff there. And like, it was a cool building. That's one of my only recollections of it. And most of my friends' dads, you know, were around and went to church there. And then probably, I don't know, fourth grade or so, we transitioned to the church that your friend Mark is the pastor of now. Mm-hmm. But at that time, he wasn't the pastor. And it was kind of a bigger church in the town where I ended up going to college. And same deal, dude. Like, most of my good friends, my best friend from, like, you know, grade school through high school, I met there. And it's interesting. We hadn't talked for a long time. Just life took us in different directions. And we had like a 90-minute phone call a couple of weeks ago. And he reminded me that like we had this Sunday school class where the teacher was really, really old and he was really hard of hearing. And he was just like,
I'd have gotten in so much trouble.
Well, that's the thing. We did. He was so old and hard of hearing. He was just like reading through the Old Testament. Like it was something really dry like that. And my buddy Russell was like, that's where we started trying to be funny together. Like that's where we started doing bits and like started trying to entertain people. And he and I were sort of those guys throughout. And, you know, we were both kind of townies. So that church really kind of serviced the intellectual elites of the area and their genius progeny. So it was all like Taylor profs, Taylor kids. And Russell and I were kind of townies. So we sort of bonded over that. I don't remember in the early years the teaching being terribly robust, but I do remember like I would sit in a pew with my buddy Davey and like we would just draw. So I remember drawing like scads of pictures during like the early years of church. And youth group was kind of an exercise in like the cool people being cool and the nerdy people being nerds. And, you know, I don't remember much of the teaching. I don't know that there was much, but to your point, it was just a place that I liked going. You know, my parents were involved there and you
your
know,
parents
my dad,
are still involved there, right?
Yeah. Still involved yeah. there. Yeah. And then at some point, and I don't know the whys of all this, right? Like they've never told me a lot, but at some point, like late high school and then through college, they moved to a different church in Muncie. And that was sort of my first brush with super, super reform people because it was a Presbyterian church. They actually had a really good pastor who was a really good Bible teacher. And I remember being impressed by that. But I also remember in true reformed fashion, the services lasting 2 hours, they would do like all 72 verses of whatever song they were singing at like an absolute dirge pace. You know what I mean? So it was like,
I do know what you mean. Yes.
Yeah. If a song could embody like a really slow person, like shuffling along and like looking at their feet,
dude,
that was
all that pops into my head right now is the hymn, "O Sacred Head Now Wounded." Because yeah. when you say dirge pace and 72 verses, that's the one. I don't know. And maybe I'm scarred from childhood, but just like it is the most funereal of hymns. And so that's in my mind, that's what I'm hearing right now.
Well, yeah, dude. And like it's the kind of musical experience where like the dude hits the first note on the piano and then there's a few seconds of silence before the second note. And you're just like, oh, my gosh. The song's going to take 11 minutes. I could like go home and cut my grass and come back and they'd still be like, you know, wrapping it up.
Or if you're Ronnie, you could get on the phone and set up an appointment to have your grass cut and then come back and they'd be on the second verse.
Exactly. If you're Ronnie, you could run home and tape a Hey Guys video and three selfies and then come back and it'd still be going. And yeah, and even like the Christmas Eve service at this church was like that. So like I remember sitting there with my dad during the Christmas Eve service that's dragging on upwards of 2 hours. And we're both just like, dude, I can't wait to get home and eat. I can't wait to get home to the snacks, you know? And like,
yes.
It was just tough, dude.
I would not have like, you said snacks, my entire existence in church from birth through age 18. Well, maybe probably age 2 through age 18 was an exercise in, finding and scavenging snacks to survive the endlessness. I loved church, but also I was there for hours every week. And so, I mean, scavenging snacks, poaching the church kitchen, digging in people's offices. Like, I mean, I was a full-on like
sweet. I found a granola bar. Sustained me for a half hour.
I was a full-on like capuchin monkey, like climbing in people's offices to be like, what kind of trail mix you got at the back of this cabinet, secretary? And, I mean, that's how I survived.
Yeah, definitely. You're like, sweet, a half-eaten bag of those, like, huge, loud pretzels that people ate in the 90s. You know, this will be great. It's like preparing to run an ultra marathon. And that was my first brush with, like, am I just an idiot? Like, is there something wrong with my brain where I can't pay attention for 2 hours? You know, because I didn't know anything about, like, actual communication theory and research. You know, I was just like, man, I must be broken, you know? And then you get into adulthood and every other person is like, no, that was a tough hang. You know? And it's like, oh, good, I'm normal, you know? But at the same time, and this is the weird calculus of reformdom, right? At the same time, that was a really good church. And like, the teaching was really amazing. And I remember learning things about the Bible and kind of having it come to life for me as a young-ish adult for the first time and being somewhat delighted and intrigued by that. Like, oh, I like the Bible. You know, like I'm learning things and this is good. It's just that I have to sit through like an hour and 20 minutes of like front matter before I get to that part, you know? And I don't know, far be it for me to know like how to do church effectively, but those are some early memories. And then like, so I got married early. I got married at 20. And then we started moving around and kind of trying to figure out the church thing on our own, which got interesting. And you know, as adults, we started gravitating toward Reformed theology and those kind of churches. And, you know, probably the biggest and longest rep that we got with that was it like early career Kevin DeYoung's church, which was a wild ride, dude. And kind of same deal, you know, trying to figure out who they were. His teaching was really good, but there were a lot of young people who were in the super obnoxious throes of like cage stage Calvinism all at the same time, which is kind of a recipe for disaster. And we were, you know, we were of that group, and it was just weird trying to figure that out. 'Cause there was kind of a, and I'll shut up and let you respond to all this. I've been talking for a long time, but there was kind of a sense of excitement connected with being with the in crowd, but you knew it was going to go really bad as soon as you were not on the inside of the in crowd, which is exactly what happened to us. And much of it, a large degree of it, was my fault,
which is exactly like movies about high school, you know,
totally,
especially in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like there are distinct parallels between cage stage Calvinism and like Mean Girls. This is the same dynamic.
Right, it is. It's a bunch of people like high on their own virtue and really too immature to like handle what they know sort of when they know it. And here's the real shame of it to me. And I got to preface all this by saying I ruined it at that church. Like I ruined it for myself. I ruined it for our family. It was my own sin that undid much of it for us. But there was also this sense of, you know, like, so everybody's like 24 to 29, right? And just high as a kite on their own virtue. And the shame of it was we had a bunch of really wise, really cool old people in that church that were kind of trying to sound some alarm bells, but nobody was listening to them. And I remember every once in a while, like grabbing a burger with one of these old guys and being like, oh my gosh, this guy's super cool. And he knows a lot. And he's telling us to pump the brakes on all this stuff. And like, nobody listened. And it was just a shame. But you're spot on with the Mean Girls thing for sure.
Yeah. I mean, what you just described is sort of the, puffed up on your own virtue and the arrogance and, that I would put myself firmly in that category from ages like 18 to 25, 7, something like that. Because I mean, having grown up in John Piper's church as John Piper's son, I just walked into Wheaton with a different I have never lacked confidence in my own personality. And then you stack on top of that the last name that people recognize and a pretty substantial theological education just by default.
Yeah.
And I was such a jackass.
I believe it.
And so like church-wise, I was looking for a church that measured up. which, of course, what does that even mean? Because the funny thing is, I didn't really like my dad's preaching. I kind of, because no kid just loves to listen to their dad talk for 40 minutes ever.
Yeah.
And I did it. I was forced to do it weekly.
Or listen to anyone talk for 40 minutes ever.
But when it's your dad, like you hear that, you just hear like the first tone of voice, you know, it's like that note in the hymn and you're like, oh, this is going to drone on endlessly. And so you just kind of tune out. But I did absorb a lot and learned how to win a lot of arguments. And so I was looking for a church that sort of checked the boxes. And of course, I didn't have a sense of like the boxes ought to have to do with wisdom and virtue and kindness and how did they love their neighbors and those kinds of things. It was just doctrinal, you know?
Yeah.
And so I ended up at a church that was very MacArthurian in its culture, really, really intent on teaching the Bible, which again, you can go a long way just on doing that, but eventually your culture will catch up to you.
Yeah.
And a really thriving college ministry that did have a much more kind of vibrant, loving, rich culture of discipleship. But my reasons for being there were iffy in terms of arrogance. And absolutely what you just said in terms of the puffed upness. Like I was just so proud of what I knew and so kind of demeaningly dismissive and disappointed in those who, like, the comments I made about Arminians at that point in my life are, you know, it's the kind of things that if they were read back to me now, I would absolutely hang my head in shame. Like, what a pretentious jerk. And so that, I mean, that was kind of my posture towards the world and church. However, because God is kind, that church was really, it taught me a ton about life in the body. I met some absolutely wonderful people who just, they were faithful Christians. They were hospitable. They were gracious. They were patient with this punk kid. I spent a couple years in the college ministry and then 2 or 3 years working with their youth ministry and helping lead that and met awesome families and had that amazing experience of, you know, I'm like 21 pouring into like a 16-year-old, 17-year-old.
Yeah.
Well, that kid is no longer a kid. He's now a peer of mine pastoring in Connecticut. And he was a train wreck of a 16-year-old then.
Sure.
And now he's leading people to Christ. And you look at that and you go, well, he says I played a part in that. My recollection is I don't have a specific, I mostly look back on those years with embarrassment, but all of that. And then, I mean, it was one of those like mixed bag things. And I ended up leaving that church because of some significant leadership issues, amongst the eldership, kind of an entrenched leadership, arrogance, what would today probably be called spiritual abuse, but that wasn't a term that existed 20 years ago, 15 years ago.
Right.
And then ended up at a church called College Church in Wheaton, which is right across from the campus.
Yeah.
And was there for 5 or 6 years. And it's another one where it's a congregational church, so really different structure, much larger church at that point. It was maybe 1,500, 2,000 people.
Yeah.
Very much like a wealthy, really well-organized, upper-crust kind of church serving Wheaton's evangelical elite.
Yeah, yep.
Which I resented. I was, again, in my arrogance, I resented that. But looking back on it now, I'm like, you know what they did? They just ran a faithful church like clockwork. They did what they did well. They didn't try to be anything they weren't. Are there things about the church that could change and be better? I'm sure. It's always the case.
Yeah.
But the things that I disliked about the church were much more on me than on them.
Yeah, no, I agree. And like, as I look back on my life, that's definitely a theme. And I would go into a church like that and have the same sort of kind of blue collar chip on my shoulder. But then you think of it and you realize, like, you know, the Wheaton cultural elites need a place to worship too. And they need somebody with the horsepower. That's a really tough crowd, right? And the Taylor crowd was tough in the same way. And the Union crowd is tough in the same way, right? Like where I am now. So you've got to have somebody in the pulpit that has the horsepower to sort of stay with those people, because those are the most well-actuallying people on the planet. Like, speaking to a room full of, you know, genius in their own mind faculty is so tough. And so at Wheaton, you've got genius faculty, you've got a whole bunch of guys with rich guy disease, which means I've done well in one thing and now I think I know everything about everything. So you've got rich guy disease, you've got, you know, arrogant genius faculty. Like, I doff my cap to anyone who can, like, pastor well in that environment. And we need churches like that, right?
Yeah. So, and I discovered a couple of things while I was there, and then one or two things in retrospect. One of them was a lot of those faculty who are perceived as genius elite approach church a lot more like, you know the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector, where the Pharisee is like, thank God I'm not like that guy. Yeah. And they approach it a lot more like the tax collector. Mm. They're geniuses in their own right, but there are so many, at least amongst, you know, good Christian faculty, who approach it much more like, you know, have mercy on me, oh God, a sinner. And they recognize their own foolishness and their own limitations while being one of the best in their field, whatever that field is.
Yeah.
I'd say the other thing was that period of life for me was one where I went through probably my biggest crisis of faith due to my own sin, my own arrogance, kind of all that stuff catches up to you. Listeners,
if
it hasn't yet, it will. And and I wrote about this and helped my unbelief. And the elders at that church taught me what shepherding somebody looks like. You know, I've been around good pastors and good elders to some degree my whole life, but that when two of them basically just one kind of clamped either arm of mine, metaphorically speaking, and were like, "We're just going to walk you through this time." We're gonna see this thing through.
Yeah, man, I had the exact same experience at Kevin's church. Same deal, like lowest point of my life sin wise. And same thing. I had two older guys, one of whom was a counselor, the other of whom was a factory worker at GM, who literally took me in and took me under their wing and kind of nursed me back to health. And I owe my life to those guys, you know, it's worth its weight in gold. So yeah, as I look back on that, there's like whatever the opposite of angst is, like is what I feel toward those guys in that church, even though the church was far from perfect. So I think this is, to me, man, it's emblematic of how the gospel and how Christ makes all things new, right? Because there would have been years in that church where I was so bent out of shape over stuff and so angsty that I could have never imagined feeling warmth and gratitude toward it, but it's exactly what I feel. And, you know, later in life here, we've settled into, I think, the kinds of reformed churches that we always wished were out there. Like, good theology, but with a heart, you know, and good theology, but with humility. And we found one our last couple of years in Michigan. We went to a church called Covenant Life Community Church, and man, they were great. And some of the dearest people in my life I met there. And yeah, it was just a lot of kindness, a lot of humility, great teaching, great body believers. We loved it. And by God's grace, we've settled into a similar church down here. Cornerstone Community Church here in Jackson, which we just adore. And I think it's interesting, and I want to hear your take on this. Having been in Reformedom for the last 25-ish years, I see these churches settling into a good groove where all of us who were arrogant, puffed up a-holes 20 years ago, we're now like in middle age, and it's kind of like they're kind of making youth group fun again. So like the trend in Reformedom was to have, and this was like early in my kids' experiences, it was like, hey, pull up to youth group, you're going to hear another boring 50-minute sermon, you know? And my kids would always come home and they were like the Michael Cera meme, you know? They were just sort of like deflated, like, hey, how was youth group? Well,
they just collapse on their face. Yeah.
Yeah. We got another 9-point sermon from a kid who's in seminary and wants to sort of tell the whole story of the Bible in one shot, you know, and like, but now it's sort of landed in a place where they're having some fun at youth group. And, it's vibrant and healthy, and I'm really happy to be there, you know, just really, really happy to be there. And, I want to serve, and I want my kids to serve, and I want my kids to love it. And I think for the most part they do. And that's just a really rich experience, you know?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you think back to, so you think, just thinking timing wise, you are a few years older than me, not a ton older than me. Mm-hmm. So like when the whole Young Restless Reformed thing took off, 98, yeah. 2000, 2002, kind of that window mm-hmm. of time, that was my high school into college career. And then when it like exploded yeah. into an industry, it was like college, post-college. So kind of,
yeah.
And when your last name is Piper and that's going on, there's just a certain sense. I mean, it's a bit of a split personality, where on the one hand, you resent everything about it.
Yeah.
Because you're tired of people recognizing your last name. But then on the other hand, there's a lot of ego in it, you know, because sure. everybody yeah. recognizes your last name. And and that was definitely the case for me. But we basically rode the wave of that thing. So the explosion of everybody falls in love with this doctrine and kind of loses their minds about it.
Yeah.
And then there's the downfall where like the hollow doctrine starts to fall apart and the hypocrisy mm-hmm. comes to bear. You know, you start mm-hmm. to see like, oh, these people we respected so much aren't actually great people. Some yeah. of them are, but they were the OGs, you know, so they're the yeah. ones who predated this thing. And, yeah. And now we're at the place where like, I think that what was good about the doctrine, which was definitively good, remains definitively good, has always been good, is still being held on to. And people are just a lot less impressed with the movement aspect. And they're like, we're not a movement. We're just the church. So
yeah.
we're going to be yeah. Cornerstone. Was it? You say Cornerstone Community. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. we're going to be Cornerstone. We're going to be Emmanuel. We really want to see God do great things, but the only way we know how to do this is preaching and loving our neighbors and creating a context where people can drag their whatever difficulties are in their life in here and just sort of appropriately being the church. Much more marked by humility than branding and that kind of thing. And it works because people like you and I and so many other people just got the pride stomped out of us.
Yeah.
I mean, in this
in
this conversation, both of us have talked about a time where our sin mm-hmm. ruined something.
Yeah.
And now we're at a place where hopefully we can be the people who walk with the young, stupid kids. Because they're
yeah.
every kid, you know, every 20-year-old is dumb.
Yeah.
Through things and be patient with yeah. them, like older people were gracious and patient with us and so mm-hmm. forth. And it yeah, I mean, my hope is that we stop. We don't hunger for movement as much as just let's build the foundation, be steady, be faithful, and like let God handle the movement side of things. You know, if he wants to start yeah. a tidal wave of something, great. But mm-hmm. we don't need to engineer this. We can just be what we've discovered through all of this stuff.
Yeah, 100%, man. Amen. That's so good and so true. And yeah, that's exactly what I want us to be, you know, and it's such a good word. Pipe, we should probably call it done. There's more good stories that we could tell about church, and maybe we do like an episode 2 at some point. Like there's a whole strain of this, and we should do this when we're together the next time. Like all the little experiences that KK and I have had living overseas and getting to see the church and people who love Christ and love the Bible, like operate overseas, has been really rich, but I could do another hour on that and you probably could too. So, we should call it good. We should say that we've wandered to and fro, and until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
Hi, I'm Beckett Cook, host of The Beckett Cook Show. I lived as a gay man in Hollywood for many, many years until I had a radical encounter with Jesus 13 years ago. Since then, I've gotten my master's degree in seminary and published a book called A Change of Affection. On my podcast, The Beckett Cook Show, I sit down with fascinating Christian scholars and thinkers to address the lies of the culture and bring the biblical truth to bear on those lies. To start listening now, go to lifeaudio.com or search for The Beckett Cook Show on your favorite podcasting platform.